this is a weird day for me. Okay. So on the moment that I'm recording this podcast, this enormous article just came out with New York Magazine about Andrew Huberman and the crazies like affairs and bad science and weird backstory. It's all sort of happened at once and I have not completely processed it. But I also had this meeting set up for today with Andrea Love, who is a sort of a science raconteur. She's an immunologist. She is the executive director of the American Lyme Disease Association. She talks a lot about how science has been misconstrued in the media and by influencers. And I was going to talk to her about the sort of shaky science around Andrew Huberman. But now we've got this big article. And honestly, guys, I have no idea where this is going to go. This is completely winged. But Andrea, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's stay out of his personal life for now. We can go into that a little bit later. But let's actually just talk about his science. Like, so he is an expert on the optic nerve with articles in Nature and Cell Reports Medicine and lots of places talking about how information comes in from the outside world, how it interacts with the autonomic nervous system. And my understanding is that it's pretty well respected in that small genre. I mean, he has supposedly at various points had a lab at Stanford, although the article has raised some questions about that. Yet, and I think when he started his podcast, there was this, you know, it actually started with like him doing sketches of the optic nerve and the brain. And he had like 2,000 followers and I'd known him for years. And I was like, oh, Andrew, no one's ever going to watch this. But lo and behold, I was wrong. Everyone watched it. And I think it was partially because he didn't dumb it down. Like he talked to you as sort of a peer, or maybe he was the student, and he used big, like long words like dopaminergic synergistic effects on the XYZ pathways. And you're like, wow, I'm learning something and this guy is legit. But there's been this progression with him where he's not just talking about the optic nerve. He's talking about basically anything, basically everything. And we get to places where I don't think he's on comfortable ground. And yet he's also sort of this high priest for, you know, all science communication. What have you seen where you're like, this doesn't quite match up to reality?
Yeah. So, you know, and I think, you know, you're right. And on a lot of those things, you know, I'm not an expert in optic nerve signaling and I would never purport to be, because just like you said, you know, scientists have these niches of expertise. You know, and for me, you know, I started to kind of see people sharing his content and I wasn't really an active listener of his podcast, but then, you know, I started to see some like sound bites, little clips that he would share on social media. And I was like, this seems a little sus. So, you know, the first thing, and you know, I mean, scientist is a very broad umbrella. You know, science could be anything from biological sciences to data science to earth sciences to physical sciences. So, you know, it's always really important that people understand that that's a really big bucket and we can't just lump mm-hmm. everybody into that category. And even beyond that, right, you have scientists and you have healthcare providers or clinicians, and those are not one and the same as well. But, you know, what I started to notice is that he was often making statements or claims about an impact to human health that was not supported by human evidence. And so, you know, this is something, so I work in life sciences, biotechnology is my full-time job. And so, you know, I work in the fields of developing assays and research and technologies for cancer immunotherapies and vaccines and cell and gene therapy and genetic engineering. And so, you know, I'm kind of immersed in a lot of these arenas that overlap with a lot of different scientific disciplines. You know, my PhD is in immunology and microbiology, but within that there's biochemistry and molecular biology, cell biology, cell signaling, and so on and so forth, because all of those things are required to understand how the immune system functions. And so, you know, something that is really important when you're working in preclinical and clinical research is that, you know, you understand the limitations of the data that you're reading. And so mm-hmm. one thing I think that you know, maybe was exploited as a result of the COVID pandemic is that, you know, we saw preprints, we saw non-peer-reviewed studies kind of coming out in rapid fire, and people really were grabbing onto whatever they could and often misinterpreting it, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not. And then there was this kind of confusion of, oh, well, is it peer reviewed? Therefore, it's credible. And that's mm-hmm. also not the full story, right? Peer review is kind of the bare minimum. But the bigger mm-hmm. story is that scientific data, regardless of the field, it accrues over time, right? We start from a singular observation or set of data, and we say, hey, what could that mean? Let's go do another study to investigate that and get some more data. And then we build on that. And that builds over time, right? So, you know, in immunology, there are receptors on innate immune cells that were not discovered. I mean, they existed, but they were not discovered until the 1990s. So my mentor, you know, who was training me, you know, they didn't exist to him. You know, he had to learn that, you know, as they were discovered. And so what happens, I think, with his podcast is that he'll often select very specifically a single paper, a single study that he wants to use as evidence to his listeners. And they're like, well, that's great. Like, he's citing a reference. He's using evidence. But the problem is that he's frequently cherry picking. So he's selectively excerpting a study that is not an appropriate research model, right? It's not in humans. It's in a petri dish. It wasn't replicated in humans, or it was in a mouse and it wasn't replicated in humans. And often that cherry-picked study is also in conflict with the, I don't know, thousands of other studies on the same topic. And so the listeners, they're not going to go fact check. They're not going to go do a literature review and kind of verify this. They're going to take him at his word because he says, well, I'm a professor of ophthalmology at Stanford. Therefore, you know, I know how to assess science. And so there's the appeal to authority, and there's this selective reporting with this inherent bias, which misleads people to think that he's presenting good science, when in reality, he's more often than not being very exclusionary about what he's presenting in order to, unfortunately, now really promote products that he is making money off of.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the, you know, I have heard, now this is not fact checked. This has just been through the rumor mill of like the 20 people I know who we send chats about Andrew Huberman, but supposedly he's making around $20 million a year with Athletic Greens and Plunge and all of these other people that he sponsors. And that is obviously that's a huge conflict of interest. But I think we should drill down in that, because when you are being supported by an audience who's giving you money for these products that you support, that can, and you want to drive audience to products because maybe you get a subscription fee to it, the way you present that material is going to be beneficial towards your sponsors, which is like, if you were going to write an academic article, this should be the biggest conflict of interest at the bottom of it as possible. I own a supplement company, and this is about supplements. And I worry so much, and of course you were just hitting on this, is that you can put one paper out there, and it might have some data in it. It's on mice, or it's in a petri dish, or it's even on like a small group of like eight people or whatever.
Yeah.
But then he extrapolates protocols. Like, it goes from petri to protocol. I mean, it just seems so obvious to me that's a problem, but why don't you tell me why that's a problem?
Yeah, absolutely. So So in the episode where he was joined by Robert Lustig and they were doing the whole demonizing of fructose, and I mean, that's been Robert Lustig's shtick for decades, you know, and I think that's another differentiator here is that, you know, his solo episodes are one thing, but then he often has guests on to join him, and it's purported as, well, they're going to be the experts on this topic because it's not my expertise. But those experts are also the outliers in their respective fields, right? He's brought on Sarah Gottfried, who spreads pseudoscience about regulating your hormones through diet. She is not respected within the OBGYN community for that misinformation. And so it's that like like, you know, dissolves like scenario where he's platforming other propagators of misinformation in their respective fields. And many of them are quite notorious and also have a lot of money from a lot of these wellness companies. But so, for example, you know, and this one really stuck out to me because it was very deliberate. So Robert Lustig is going on about how ultra processed foods cause bone damage. It retards bone development. And they're talking about it. And then, you know, and first of all, there's no standard definition of what an ultra processed food is. You know, I've written about a lot about the fear mongering as it relates to processing of foods, and a lot of processing is, you know, for shelf life or nutrition or whatever. But anyway, so Andrew goes, oh, that's really interesting. Like, where did they find, or he said, was this an in vitro or an in vivo study? And Lustig goes, in vivo. And Andrew goes, oh, where did they find people for that? And Lustig goes, in Israel. So my ears perked up because I'm a pretty skeptical person to begin with.
Okay, and let's define in vitro.
Yes.
Our audience here.
So in vitro is a scientific term for cells in a petri dish. So basically, if you're growing cells on a piece of plastic, you would call that an in vitro study. In vivo in science means in life, but typically we're referring to an animal model, so in a whole organism. But in this instance, Andrew was misleading people to believe that in vivo was a clinical study, which means in humans. So we also often use the term preclinical to refer to non-human research, and then clinical to refer to anything involving human subjects. So he said in vitro or in vivo. He didn't say clinical study. But then he said, oh, well, where did you find those, or where did they find those people? And he said in Israel. So I used that information to find this paper. And it was in mice, and it was like 12 mice, and it wasn't even a consistent, you know, data set. And so, you know, this was a very deliberate misleading in order to promote Robert Lustig's book, and also these supplements that they were promoting and selling on this episode, prebiotic, probiotics, because the whole, you know, the whole big takeaway of the episode was, you know, processed foods are killing you, and it's insulin that's causing kidney damage, and fructose is the demon, and, you know, all of these really hyperbolic claims that, you know, as a good scientist, you would know that there's a lot more nuance and context, but he's presenting it in a way that it's definitive. And so people are now scared to eat, you know, fruits because there's fructose in them. They're scared to have a teaspoon of sugar in their coffee because they've been told that sugar is the devil. And so, you know, it's not just, oh, you're giving these supplement companies money. It is your changing things in your life that don't have human evidence to support them. Some of them might seem benign, but some of them are actively harmful. And that, you know, that was even more illustrated in his cold and flu episode, because he was actively discouraging people from the real science-backed things that reduce disease severity of respiratory illnesses, like vaccinations, and hyping his cold plunge tub that he's sponsored by, his AG1 supplements that he's sponsored by, nose breathing. And of course, he makes a lot of jargon-filled statements, like he throws around the word nitric oxide signaling and all of that, which again, these are tangential concepts in science that he's misapplying in order to appear credible. And so, you know, with a platform of whatever, 5-10 million people, by telling people that the flu vaccine is extraordinarily safe and it prevents 50% of flu illnesses, thousands of deaths, thousands of hospitalizations every year, he could have improved health outcomes. But instead, he diminished the severity of flu. He didn't even talk about the public health impact of flu every single year, how many people it kills every single year. And he was like, well, you know, I don't get the flu because, you know, I'm a pretty big, strong, tough guy. And, you know, I'm not around people, so I couldn't infect them. When, first of all, we know that's not true. We know he has big speaking events and so on. He goes to the gym with RFK Jr. But second of all, like, what about infecting other people? What about your risk of transmitting a potentially fatal illness to immunocompromised people in your community, elderly people in your community, young children in your community? You know, there's just this lack of, like, general concern for public health. And ultimately, it's so he can promote these health hacks that he makes a lot of money off of.
You know, it seems that there's a conversation that he's part of, which is sort of a parallel health infrastructure in America, right? And maybe we could say this globally, where we have, obviously we have Western medicine with all its benefits and flaws, and it's flawed and it has good things about it, right? But then there's these parallel understandings that have been sort of accumulating in pop culture. And, you know, you mentioned nitrous oxide and nasal breathing, and that's sort of something that I have written about. I have a book called The Wedge, where I do talk about how nasal breathing could be beneficial in some training instances. And yet, I also have noticed that when writing about these things, you also get people who hear about nasal breathing and then say, oh, this cures everything. If I breathe through my nose, not only will I filter out COVID, I will also make myself more performative in like a million other ways. And it's different for every person. Everyone has a different set of things that it does for them. Same with ice plunges, same with breath work, same with now, I guess, looking at the sun in the morning. I guess that's a Huberman thing. But what's interesting about it is the logic in these wellness worlds seem to build on each other. Like nitrous oxide, you know, maybe there's this idea of hypoxia in there, and maybe hypoxia leads to hormesis, and hormesis leads to these other ideas that are scientific, but it's like parallel scientific. So how do we bridge that world? Because personally, I'm very interested in saying, look, ice baths are great. I take them all the time. I do saunas all the time. But I don't want to make an overblown statement, which is, I feel like, where the Huberman protocols go to immediately. So how do we, as humans, deal with this?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And I would say it's less of a parallel, but more of a, it's hyperbole. I think that's really what it is. And so it really boils down to the difference between science and pseudoscience, right? So science is something that has robust, valid, reproducible, repeatable data to support it. Pseudoscience on the surface looks like science, but it doesn't have any of those things. It has personal testimonials, anecdotes, appeal to emotion, appeal to authority, and it uses jargon to sound legitimate. And this is something that the wellness industry, which is a multi-trillion-dollar industry, and it includes your supplements, which are wholly unregulated pharmaceuticals, you know, we need to just call them what they are. They're made in a lab, they're pharmaceuticals, they're just unregulated, and they don't have evidence to support their safety and their efficacy. Mm-hmm. But it also includes these other biohacking things, right? The plunge pools, the saunas, the inside tracker health tests, the digital, you know, the continuous glucose monitors for non-diabetics, the heart rate monitors, you know, all these sorts of things that are sold to consumers as ways to optimize your health or your mm-hmm. performance or ultimately overload you with information. So what happens is pseudoscience is often built on a nugget of truth, right? A grain of reality. So something like, there's a pathway where your cells can eat themselves, and it's called autophagy, is wildly exaggerated by your nutrition gurus to claim that you can intermittent fast your way to autophagy and therefore cure yourself of all that ails you. Mm-hmm. And so what ends up happening is that most of these people misunderstand or just have no fundamental science knowledge. They hear a term that sounds very appetizing to their audience, and they run with it. And that's why it kind of builds on each other. And that's why it's mm-hmm. almost predictable, the lines that I know I'm going to hear when I debunk a certain claim. Mm-hmm. But it all grows from, I think, this human desire to want to have control over our health. And so if you can buy a product that promises to help you with that, you know, that's very appealing. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, as much as you would love to have control over all those things, you don't. We don't have that much control. We have far less control over our bodies and our health than we would like to believe. There's a lot of fundamentals that are really important, But those don't make people a lot of money because they're the fundamentals. It's good sleep. It's eating a diverse diet. That means a lot of different things. It means getting some regular exercise. It means practicing good hygiene. And that's all types of hygiene, you know, personal hygiene, sexual hygiene, oral hygiene, you know, getting your vaccines that prevent against communicable illnesses, you know, limiting things we know are harmful or have causal evidence of harm, like smoking and alcohol consumption. Doesn't mean you have to be terrified of alcohol. I know he kind of scared people in one of his episodes about that. It does mean that, you know, there's a risk associated with it. But again, it becomes very appealing to feel like, well, if you have all these tools in your toolkit, and he phrases it in that very deliberate way, like this is your zero cost toolkit, this is your no cost toolkit, you know, now people feel like, well, now they're taking control. Now they're taking the power back. Right. When in reality, like a lot of things are somewhat predetermined in your genetics and your epigenetics. That's another buzzword that is misappropriated. And there's a lot of other things that we just don't have explanations for. You know, science is so incredibly complex, and our ability to tease out, you know, nuance and complex processes is not fully understood. You know, we learn something new every day, but the wellness industry kind of exploits that. They're like, well, you know, Western conventional medicine won't tell you this, but we're going to sell you a cure for this, you know, fatigue and lethargy and GI upset. And we're going to call it leaky gut, or we're going to call it toxic mold. They're going to slap a name on it and then sell you a protocol that's going to cure you, when they're not actually helping you. They're exploiting you. They're exploiting the limitations of real science, making money off of it. And ultimately, they're causing harm because, in addition to, you know, selling you these things that have no evidence to support them, it causes people to delay legitimate medical treatment.
You know, science progresses, and it progresses at a very slow rate, much, much slower than what our desire is for where it can be. And we also know, without a doubt, that lifestyle affects health, right? We know that the things you do in life will affect you. And if it's just, we can just use the example, which I'm sure someone's going to put in the comments. If you eat a ton of sugar, you're going to get, you know, you're going to get really fat. You might get diabetes. Like, it can go down this road. And then people will write in these comments, we have a natural obesity epidemic. And, you know, he's talking about how we can change that to some degree. And I think that there's some sort of balance here between the more reductive parts of science and what our desire is, because at some point it could be, in theory, that some of his protocols may work, right? In theory, in a very, very broad theory, something he says might actually happen to be right, because that's what a hypothesis is, you state something that might be true and then you test it. A lot of his things, though, by their nature, cannot be tested. Right, you cannot test to see if Athletic Greens' proprietary supplementation of nanoparticles or whatever's in Athletic Greens will have a certain outcome. What you can say is that somebody is very anxious about a part of their health, gets a tool to help them control their health, they might actually feeling like you're in control may actually help your anxiety. So there's a whole bunch of interrelated issues here. And teasing them apart is, I think, that what every listener of Andrew Huberman is trying to do, where they're trying to get some control, and he offers you a sense of it. And sometimes it's right, sometimes it's not. Actually, probably more often than not, it's not right. But I don't know how to actually tease it out. I don't know how to be like, look, just go talk to a doctor, talk to your scientist, and then they'll be able to send you on the way. Because that's also an appeal to authority in a way. Like, my listeners are often very, very confused about this world and how to actually navigate it in a reasonable way. Because not all doctors are great. Some doctors are shiesty. Our health system is a shambles.
There's a lot of crap people in every career, you know. And I think, and it is really hard. And that's why I think the... You know, I think we have to talk about things we know, the limitations of what we know, but not make it into something that it's not. And I think that's really where the problem is, right? You know, he makes patently false statements about a variety of basic biological processes, and he does that and then promotes a hack that exploits that false statement. But But in some ways, you know, there are some benchmarks that people can use. And I know that a lot of his listeners really reject the idea of consensus because they're listening to him because they think that he's going to tell them a secret that everyone else is hiding, right? He kind of thrives on this contrarian persona, and that's why he platforms other contrarians. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when we talk about the term scientific consensus, we're not talking about a bunch of scientists sitting at a table and like, yeah, well, yeah, we all agree on that. You know, mm-hmm. we're talking about consensus means something very different when we say scientific consensus than like consensus on where we're going to go to dinner tonight. Right. Scientific consensus means that when you look at the quality and quantity of evidence on a topic, there is a clear position that those in the field would conclude based on those data. So mm-hmm. when we talk about scientific consensus about, say, the flu, scientific yeah. consensus data demonstrate that the flu vaccine is safe and effective and is incredibly mm-hmm. beneficial. Or when we talk about scientific consensus about fluoride treatment for oral health, scientific consensus data demonstrate that fluoride applied to your teeth, whether it's in fluoridated toothpaste or drinking fluoridated water, reduces the rate of dental caries, gingivitis, tooth decay, cavities, so on and so forth. So when you look at those bodies of data, it's often mm-hmm. shared by public health governmental agencies. And so he cultivates an audience that is suspicious of authority, right? Mm-hmm. He uses his authority as a professor while simultaneously suggesting to people that governmental authorities, pharmaceutical authorities, regulatory authorities shouldn't be trusted. And that's kind of the same playbook that Joe Rogan uses, who was someone that platformed him initially. So, you know, he got a lot of listeners from that original platforming. And so, you know, I think there's not a good solution, right? You know, we need transparency in how we communicate science, but we also have to get people to understand that we don't have all the answers. And that's not to say, oh, you should go listen to this guy who's just selling you mm-hmm. snake oil. But yes, we get new information every single day. And this is accrued and analyzed by hundreds or thousands of mm-hmm. experts in a field. You can't just listen to this singular person that mm-hmm. speaks in a calm voice and you know, gives you good vibes, because that's not how science works. And that's especially true now that he's at a point where he publicly states that his research for these episodes is just talking to a couple of bros, you know, mm-hmm. like in his cold and flu episode, you know, several people were like, well, you know, Andrea has actually said, you know, myself and a couple of others on Instagram, you know, that, you know, this is not the main mode of transmission. This is not, you know, how you protect against the flu. And he was like, well, I talked to 3 MDs about this, so I'm going to stick with this content, you know? And then, you know, his followers are like, well, you should write to him because he has an open comment for him. It's like, yeah, he doesn't care about legitimate critiques mm-hmm. because now he's created this environment that actively rejects what scientific consensus is on a topic. And that's why in his oral health episode, mm-hmm. you know, he platformed the Ask the Dentist guy, who's not even a practicing dentist, and he promotes misinformation about dental health, including that fluoride is a toxin.
Hi, it's me. I'm breaking into the middle of this show because I just wanted to remind you that this is a very, very tiny podcast, and I'm taking on players who make millions and millions of dollars a year with giant legal teams and white-shoed PR firms, but we're trying to get out the truth. And so if you liked this interview with Dr. Andrea Love, I'd love you to consider getting early access to this and other shows that I put out on Patreon. It means a lot if you can support, you know, the work I do. If not, no worries at all. You know, like, subscribe, get the word out. And, you know, I just really appreciate you listening to this really important conversation. So without further ado, we're going right back to it. I think it's very important to note that he has become this sort of the arbiter of science for many people. I mean, the way he introduces his podcast is thank you for your interest in science, as if he is the one who is the person who gets to decide instead of a scientific consensus. And one thing that's, I think, very, very problematic here is that he's also talking specifically about health. It's not just the optic nerve, but Andrew Huberman has a PhD in neuroscience. He's a specifically on the optic nerve. Does that qualify him to be an MD?
No, no, absolutely not. And I think, you know, and by the same token, you know, there's a lot of MDs who I think overestimate their scientific prowess with regard to study evaluation and assessment of data. And so, you know, but there's this confusion, right? You know, if someone has a PhD in some sort of biomedical science, then often they are confused with a clinician. More often than not, it's the opposite. But because of the way that he promotes information, because it's all about optimizing your health, in many ways, he is making prescriptions to people. Now, he's not doing it on a one-on-one basis. And because he's not a licensed healthcare provider, there's limited kind of legal oversight for that. But he's certainly making statements to a broad audience that causes them to alter their behaviors in a way that impacts their health.
Which, to go back to the article for a moment, and I'm talking about the article in New York Magazine, one thing that I have personally noticed with Huberman, I've known him since 2017. So before he got famous, the COVID pandemic really made Andrew Huberman famous because all these people had this health anxiety. They were looking for information sources. They found Huberman and he had answers. And for a while he seemed reasonable. And then I think he has had this shift at some point in another direction. But I want to go even before that. The title of this article was about the title of this article was Falling for Huberman, and it was about how he is a manipulative individual. And I would say that from my own experience, I have seen that time and again, where, for instance, you know, in the article I'm quoted saying, he invited me out on a camping trip. It was going to be some bros going out. We're going to go into the woods. We're going to hike around and, you know, see the sequoias and stuff like that. And I thought it was going to be cool because, you know, it's good to have friends. And like, he was not famous. There was no any of that part of it. I went there, I showed up at his door, and he wasn't there. He wasn't there, he didn't show up until like 5 p.m., I didn't see him. And because he was out doing things, he was out working on grants, he was doing things, which is really weird when you show up to camp with somebody, and it's been, and you fly across the country to do it, and he sort of, it just sort of ghosts you, which is a pattern throughout that article where he does this with women. A woman flies in from out of the country, and he's not there because supposedly, he's sleeping with another woman at that time. And here's my pop diagnosis of Andrew Huberman, is that he enjoys building up someone's expectations and then having the power to rip those expectations out. He enjoys that manipulation of people. And I think when we talk about his podcast, I think this is why he loves protocols. I think this is why he loves Huberman husbands and Daddy Huberman hashtags, and all of the people who wake up and look at the sun for some reason. I think he likes that because he has influence over people, and that serves a drive that's not about the science, but it's actually a psychological piece of him. Which feeds into this question about charisma. This is why charisma is so dangerous and why consensus is actually really important. So what do we do, Andrea? You have a PhD. You're obviously more credentialed than me. Where do we go? Because I think what people's reactions are is, hey, I read this article and Huberman's having sex with all these women. And some of them are going to be like, cool, what a bro. And other people are going to be like, who cares about his personal life? His science is great. And it seems like the only action someone can take is subscribe to some other podcast. Subscribe to my podcast. It's Scott Carmen. Like, I mean, seriously, what's going on? How do we do this? I mean, are we canceling Huberman? Is that what we're trying to do here? Like, did that solve anything?
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard. There's no easy answer, right? You know, I mean, there's a lot of problems with kind of how society consumes information in this day and age. There's a rejection of authority in some ways, but then there's an adulation of authority in the context of Andrew Huberman. And so, you know, it's interesting because I've debunked a lot of, you know, his specific false statements in my area of expertise. And it's always, you know, the fanboys come after me quite aggressively. And it's always, well, you're not famous. Why should we listen to you? And it's like,
right.
That's.
Yeah. What's your follower count?
Fame has nothing to do with the science you're doing. Right. You know, I mean, and this is kind of a societal problem, but it's also, you know, it goes to, you know, what's the burden on social media platforms to help fact check, you know, I mean, right now there's no fact checking. Right. And then also, you know, you've got this multi-trillion dollar wellness industry that is funding his podcast, right? He didn't have the reach and the followers until he first got platformed by Joe Rogan. Then he started to get the sponsors who are giving him millions and millions of dollars. You know, I had a podcast for 4 years and it was completely self-funded and volunteer on my part. And I spent 40 hours a week actually prepping on topics that I was, you know, well-versed in. And we rejected every sponsorship because we're not going to hawk supplements because there's no evidence behind them. And so, you know, what's the business model if people who say they want to dispel scientific misinformation and promote good science, you know, there's no investment in that infrastructure. And those who are just going about their business, doing their science on a day-to-day basis, you know, those who are in the lab or in academia and in industry, you know, they don't have a platform. They're just doing science, right? And so, you know, they're probably contributing to life-saving medications, right? Or developing new, you know, understanding of genetic disorders or whatever the case happens to be. And so, you know, I don't have a solution, right? It really has to be a paradigm shift. It has to be a shift in how people respect expertise, but also understand the limitations of it. You know, understand that you can't simply just go to PubMed and type some fluoride is toxic and then pull up whatever paper comes up and said, this is my evidence, because that's not what literature search is. And I think there's also this perception, and I think it really goes to this, you know, people want control over their health. They want to be able to feel like they can do more than just the basics, right? That there are things that you can change. And I think, you know, yes, there are some things you can change, right? You know, some of the basics, right? If you're sedentary, try to be less sedentary. If half of your diet is pizza, try to have less than half of your diet pizza. But there's no harm in indulging every now and then, right? It's trends. It's not singular inputs that are going to make or break you. And I think, you know, he creates the illusion that it's these singular inputs, these protocols that are going to make or break your health. And the reality is not that. But beyond that, you know, we have to get to a place where, you know, people realize that the wellness industry and the people that promote these products like Huberman, it's not altruistic. It's money-making. And it's just as money-making as the regulated pharmaceutical industry. It's just unregulated. And in many ways, it's worse because it's making money by selling lies to people. Whereas at least with regulated medications, there's oversight. There's other people looking at the data. There's other people deeming whether or not this is safe to administer, at what dosage it's safe to administer, who should get it, and how can they get access to it. But people think that just because something is labeled as all natural or some, you know, supplement company says that it's got buzzwords in it like adaptogens and, you know, xenobiotics and all these things that really don't mean anything. They're marketing buzzwords. That it's benign, and it's not. You know, these things, especially the ones that have proprietary labels, they're not disclosing what's in them. Those can have harmful interactions with actual medications. They can exacerbate pre-existing health conditions. You know, it's not the supplements that are being promoted and sold are not benign, right? There are things that you're putting in your body that many of which you don't actually know what's in them.
It's interesting. Oversight, you would think, would be a thing that people want, right? They would want people, I would think that people want some element of quality control in the world, because you don't want people to lie. You want to get the real thing that you bought when you put your money down, like you think that it would. But I believe that society at large has pushed in a direction where oversight is actually a detraction, because people will say in the pharmaceutical business, look at all of these negative outcomes for the COVID vaccine, for instance. And you will go and you will find negative outcomes for the COVID vaccine. It will be there because everything has a negative outcome in this world if you look at individuals. And because they reported it in VAERS or wherever, therefore people will use that to discredit something because it has transparency and because it has oversight. Whereas something without oversight, something that is just completely flim-flam and made up, it's weird that society allows that. And it's like, well, look, there's no evidence that you know, name your conspiracy theory is not true. So it's got to be true. It's, you know, there's this old saying, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. That makes sense. But I think that what we're talking, it's actually the logical fallacy of today is the absence of evidence is not evidence of anything. Like it's such a dumb moment we're in. And also with oversight, I've noticed with this article in New York Magazine, I've been talking to all the women, not all of them, but several of the women who came forward, and I know their real names versus their pseudonyms. And I will say, there is so much more there than what ended up in that article.
I talked to one of them. They reached out to me several months ago, and we had a very long conversation, and it's pretty shocking. But you're absolutely right. You know, it's that argument from ignorance, right? You know, if we don't have evidence of it, that doesn't mean it's not there. And it's very interesting, the disconnect, right? You know, if someone is a scientist for a pharmaceutical company, they're corrupt and they're a shill and they're selling out and they're just towing the company line. But if there's a scientist for a supplement company, then they're doing God's work, you know, according to
the
wellness
rebel
industry. Right. But people don't realize that supplement companies are pharmaceutical companies. Mm-hmm. They're just not regulated pharmaceutical companies. So, you know, it's a very bizarre disconnect psychologically. And I don't have an answer for that. It certainly, you know, goes to the appeal to nature fallacy and a lot of that as well. Because people just don't have there's not good science literacy. There's not good education. And really that's kind of exploited. But it also pulls in that conspiratorial mindset, right? And we know that people who buy supplements or, subscribe to things like organic, non-GMO, like all these other non-evidence-based, you know, marketing buzzwords that are used to mark up the price tag of products, they're actually more likely to believe in medical and health conspiracies, like vaccines are microchipped, like sunscreen is actually causing cancer. And so there's a convergence of the biohacker wellness industry and conspiracy theorists. And really that's kind of, you know, the audience here that's being exploited by this. It's, well, don't trust the vaccines. I'm not gonna go out and say, don't get the flu shot. I'm just going to tell you why I don't get the flu shot. And I'm going to let you make your own decision, but I'm going to sell you this supplement, which is going to be filled with all these things that are going to help your gut health and your microbiome. And I'm going to throw around a lot of jargon that the way I'm using it is not actually relevant or even, they're not even related to each other. I'm just throwing a bunch of protein names together to sound very credible, like I'm doing a deep dive. I've gotten that comment, right? He does really deep dives. And I'm like, no, he actually just rambles for 2 hours. And there's no substance behind it. He could fit a lot of meat in that time, but it's more convincing to his listeners if he's circuitous and just kind of going off on tangents the entire time. And, you know, even the topics that, you know, maybe he's well-versed in, exercise, fitness, whatever, he gets things wrong about because he's not even doing the bare minimum of even a Google search. You know, he made claims about how cortisol activates your innate immune cells, when in reality, it has the opposite effect. It's an immunosuppressive chemical. That's why we use corticosteroids for autoimmune disorders, because it suppresses your immune response. And so, you know, it's almost like he, at this point, he's got so many followers that nobody is going to dare to fact check him. He doesn't even do any iota of preparation, and he'll just say whatever he feels like, and people take it as fact.
You know, I think another thing that occurs here is a fetishization of certain scientific words, for instance, serotonin and dopamine, testosterone, and what, and you know, you name your biomarker, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. and it's like, well, no one cared what their dopamine levels were, other than in very specific syndromes, 6 years ago. No one was saying, oh, this is going to up my dopamine, this is going to lower my dopamine, you know, I need more serotonin. Like, as I understand those levels, and I'm not a total expert on this stuff, I'm not an expert, but like, those things are moving around all the time. Like, dopamine's going up and down and up and down. And like, there's this idea, it's like, no, you need to optimize your dopamine, you need to get it in the right place. And same with testosterone. Everyone who listens to Huberman's ends up on testosterone. And there's a whole supplement company like Blokes and these other ones, which I, as I understand the prescription methodology on Blokes, is you have a problem and the answer is always testosterone.
Always. Yeah.
And it's like these words, because they're science sounding, are fetishized and given meaning that they don't actually even have.
Yeah. And the other part, and that's a lot of the, like, the pseudoscience methodology too. It's extrapolating a term or a phenomenon that has maybe a place in a very specific disease state, and then it's applying it to everything. And so, like, on the Lustig episode, you know, Huberman says 93% of Americans have leaky gut, which is not remotely true. Leaky gut is not a medical condition. In very specific gastrointestinal disorders that are, the pathology leads to cellular changes in the mucosal epithelial cells of the intestinal lining. And these are things like autoimmune celiac disease and so on. And that's been co-opted by the wellness industry to basically say, well, you know, toxins and food particles and bacteria are leaking out of your gut into your bloodstream, and that's why you have headaches and fatigue and bloat and et cetera. And you can take my health tests, and then you can take my supplements, and it'll cure you. And so it becomes, again, like, they want to put a label on it. They want to feel like they're having control of it. And then it makes them feel like they're in on a secret, right? Like, they're in on this health phenomenon that conventional medicine is going to lie to you about, right? And it's not just him, right? You know, Glucose Goddess is selling a supplement that's going to stabilize your blood sugar spikes, when your blood sugar is supposed to move up and down when you eat things, as long as you have a functioning pancreas. You know, Huberman talks a lot about the vitamin D. That's his whole thing for why you have to go put your eyeballs in the sun. And the whole vitamin D industry is wild. I wrote a piece about, you know, the inflation of testing thresholds and Michael Holick and his whole push to over supplement people on vitamin D. But, you know, even if you go get a vitamin D test, right, they're looking at circulating levels. You store vitamin D precursor in your fat cells in your liver, and it can be utilized if you're not exposed to the sun on a given day. And so those blood tests aren't even representative of all the vitamin D that you have available in your body. And so it's the same logic with all these other tests, right? He uses, even when he talks about, like, you know, immune cell performance or whatever, he was citing the terrible Finnish sauna study as a very good study, which is not a very good study at all. But they're looking at circulating levels of immune cells. And, you know, because he doesn't know immunology, he doesn't realize that immune cells live in your lymph organs, they live in your spleen, they're in your lymph nodes, they're in tissues, they're not just hanging out in your blood. And especially if you're doing something to your body, like sitting in a sauna, they're going to move around, and that's just what they do, because immune cells aren't, you know, they're not stationary. They move around your body because they're patrolling for foreign invaders. And so, you know, not to mention the fact that that study had no difference in any of the outcomes and it had 8 people in it. But, you know, the problem is again, you know, you exploit this kind of fundamental lack of understanding and the cherry picking of studies, and then saying, oh, well, you go sit in a sauna, that's going to boost your immunity. And people are like, well, hell yeah, I want to boost my immunity because that's going to make me healthier. If my immune system is pumped up, that means I'm not going to get sick. That means I'm not going to get this. And, you know,
well, that there,
you can't flex it. You can't flex your immune system.
Well, there are arguments, I would say, that for sauna, for instance, if you think that the fever is a response to a sickness coming into your body, and it is, it's an effective way to deal with illness that has been evolutionary around for a while. The sauna allows you to raise your body temperature without expending energy. That's probably beneficial to some degree, but it's certainly not a panacea in the way that it has been created. I'm not even really sure what they mean by heat shock proteins, the way they get described in, you know, by people like Huberman. But I do want to point out another thing before I go down that rabbit hole, because that is a rabbit hole for me, which is, if you look at placebos, right, the whole idea of a placebo, there have been many studies that show that somebody who is more suggestible actually has a higher placebo response. So that if you're a super suggestible person, you're more likely to increase on the benefits of whatever medication, placebo or otherwise, you get. And this is something that can be hacked. And that is something I would say is arguably good. Like if you were sick or you felt sick, and then you were less sick at the end of it, being suggestible is actually clinically good if you want to enhance the placebo effect. But in areas where the placebo effect doesn't play any role, for instance, let's just say an antibiotic, you have an infection, it doesn't matter how suggestible it is, the infection needs to be treated. There is this certain window where confidence expressed to your patient is consoling and has therapeutic outcomes that are beneficial. For instance, Rohan Francis, who's a friend of mine, he's a famous YouTuber. I think you've retweeted him on the tweet thread things before. Rohan will say, look, I will take a picture of your heart with like an echocardiogram or whatever, and it'll be a bad heart. And at the end of the operation, he'll show you the picture again. And he'll say, this is a good heart. And he says to the people he does this to, they have improved outcomes. So that's good, right? And I think that this placebo response and understanding that that is an important thing is something that we as people who want to get better do need to maximize. On the other hand, when you start to maximize it, you end up in this fucking hole of bullshit. You know? So yeah.
I mean that's you know, a lot of the crux of it, right? You know, you have this line to walk as a human being, as a functioning member of society, you know, me as a scientist who is, you know, a particularly skeptical scientist, and you know, there's a moral conflict about, you know, misleading someone for their benefit or for their detriment or for maybe something that's neutral to them, but it's benefiting you and maybe it's mm-hmm. detrimental to society, right? So it's this very kind of gray area. And so, you know, yeah, the placebo effect can be very powerful, as can the nocebo effect, right? And we have a lot of data to demonstrate that. And you know, certainly clinicians utilize that and it can be very effective, especially for post-op recovery and a lot of those sorts of things. You know, if people feel like this surgery, you know, you're going to have smooth sailing, you know, that's going to improve outcomes as opposed to someone, you know, exiting mm-hmm. the operating suite and being told that was touch and go there, you know? Mm-hmm. But again, like that's on an individual basis, right? When you're interacting with a patient on a patient by patient basis, here we're talking about him making unsubstantiated claims to essentially the population at large. And I would argue that while people taking a supplement, there might be a placebo effect, I think that that is outweighed by the harms of taking the supplements that can cause actual like medical harms, but also the bigger societal harms of the rejection of science more broadly, the espousal and kind of promotion of anti-science legislation. You know, it's beyond just I'm buying the supplement, I'm taking the supplement. Now we're seeing measles outbreaks because of anti-vaccine and anti-science rhetoric. You know, we had eradicated that 24 years ago and now it's back and it's killing people, you know? And so again, you know, how do we rein that in, right? How do we rein in kind of, you know, yes, science says this. Yes, there's a lot science doesn't know. So we can't be completely rigid about everything we say. But on the other side, well, you can't just fly by the seat of your pants and put whatever you want into your body. And it's really interesting that, you know, anti-vaccine people are like, well, I'm not injecting that into my body while they're covered in tattoos and they're eating all the supplements and none of those things are regulated. And yes, I have plenty of tattoos. So, you know, I do it both. But you know, again, there's that psychological disconnect where this one thing is perceived as, well, I'm not putting that into my body because it's toxic. And then the other is, well, this thing that has no science behind it is definitely beneficial to me. So I'm definitely going to put it in my body.
I'm ready to go down to the Amazon to take a random tar tasting substance ayahuasca ceremony for 4 days, because I'm sure that's going to fix my stuff. Like, yes, 100%. We put stuff into our bodies all the time and we have no idea what they do. Why does the jibber jab, why is that the bad one, right? Like,
yes.
The jibber jab has come up so often in my comments lately. I just find it hilarious. I don't know why that's the word, but it's in the last few weeks. Andrea, this is a great conversation. Where do people find you and more about you?
Yeah, so I have a newsletter. It's called Immunologic. So you can find it on my website. It's immunologic.org, spelled just like it sounds. I'm on Instagram and Threads. My handle is @dr.andrealove. And then you can also find the American Lyme Disease Foundation, which is we debunk Lyme misinformation and tick-borne disease misinformation. It's ALDF.com.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you coming onto this podcast. And everyone, go check out her stuff. It's great. My literary agent told me to talk to her. Oh. So that's a big deal. You know, from Scott Carney Investigates in Denver, Colorado, this was Scott Carney Investigates. Wait, no, from Pokey Bear LLC in Denver, Colorado, this was Scott Carney Investigates.